MacCast, Wednesday, January 16th, 2013. Hey, MacGeeks, it's time for your MacCast, the show for MacGeeks by MacGeeks. I'm Adam, and this is the show where we discuss all things Macintosh. How you doing? Welcome back to the MacCast. Well, we've got another week gone by and another week of Mac news and hints and tips and tricks to bring to you. But before we get started, I want to take a quick moment and thank one of our show sponsors, and that's Circus Ponies. Circus Ponies Notebook is a great application for almost any Mac user. And I know I've told you a lot about its cool features, like its drawing tools, its flags, its sticky notes, its integration with calendars and to-dos and contacts, even cool stuff like the multi-dex indexing feature that makes searching really easy and powerful. But you know what? It's just a really good note-taking application as well. And we forget to talk about that. You know, we're talking about these advanced features all the time. You can just type straight in, say, if you were writing a paper or a short story or a novel, so you can write those types of notes. Or it's also really great for doing outlines. It has support for multiple styles and indent levels. You can customize all the settings for that. It even has support for the Cornell note-taking system, which is one of the most popular ways of taking notes. And then on top of that, there's all that kind of fun stuff, like the ability to customize the style of your notebook with different types of paper. You want legal pad, you want college ruled, you want graph, it's all in there, and you can mix and match to your heart's content, and different kinds of binding styles and all sorts of stuff, so you can really personalize it. And it's just really simple, powerful, and versatile. So you know, you should just grab your copy today, and even if you're just a bit curious about the application, there's a free 30-day trial available, so you can download it, try before you buy. Please just go check it out. Circusponies.com is the website, and I want to say a big thank you to them for their support of the MacCast. In Apple news over the past week or so, a lot of speculation has been being thrown around as to what Apple's next generation products are going to be. We're hearing about new iPads, new iPhones, other services that Apple might be working on. But arguably one of the bigger stories of this week was that Apple is also working on a cheaper version of the iPhone. That had been being pumped up, and later in the week, Apple's senior vice president of marketing, Phil Schiller, reportedly in an interview with the Shanghai Evening News, denied that Apple would be bringing out a lower cost version of the iPhone. And I say allegedly because Reuters, which originally broke the story, withdrew their report later in the same day after it made the blog rounds, supposedly after they discovered that the source they had used, Shanghai Evening News, had made significant changes to their original reporting. Now, it's unclear if the report was inaccurate because it didn't change, they didn't make any changes to the parts of the story that discussed what Phil Schiller had said. And the Next Web did confirm with Apple that the interview did take place. And at that time, I guess Apple didn't make any statements to the fact that what was said in the report, specifically by Schiller, was inaccurate or not. And apparently in the report, Phil Schiller explained that Apple's not going to do a cheaper iPhone because it simply isn't how Apple does things. He cited the fact that Apple's focus is on bringing out products with the best design, materials, and customer experience, and those are the things that drive Apple, not the price point. There had been reports from the Wall Street Journal that Apple was looking to debut a low-cost iPhone sometime in 2013 and to try and possibly woo customers who are looking at those lower-cost Android devices. Another potential driver for a lower-cost iPhone would be that Apple's looking to gain ground in emerging markets like China, where many consumers simply can't afford their premium-priced products. And that would be, I think, more of a driving factor for Apple than any competition that they're getting from Android. As a matter of fact, Apple CEO Tim Cook was in China last week meeting with the chairman of China Mobile. That's China's largest mobile carrier and the only one, the only national carrier currently in China not carrying the iPhone, trying to supposedly reach a deal to get the iPhone on that network. So Apple has a long history, I think, of saying one thing and then doing exactly the other thing only a few months later. And I think it's important when you're reading these reports to remember that there is a difference between Apple selling a cheap smartphone and a cheaper, i.e. lower cost iPhone. And I don't think I'm necessarily splitting hairs there. Some of you might think that, you know, it's just a semantics issue. But remember that Tim Cook vehemently denied that Apple would come out with a 7-inch iPad just months, if not weeks, before they released the iPad mini, and still to this day says that it's not a 7-inch iPad because it's 7.9 and that it is more like a full-sized iPad and it doesn't have the kinds of compromises that a lot of the 7-inch tablets have in Apple's mind. But I think consumers don't really see things that way. And I also think it's important to remember that as Apple's products mature, they tend to start to diversify the product designs and price points to help keep their leadership position in the market. And I think the iPhone at this point has kind of reached that maturity level. So it wouldn't be shocking to see Apple breaking out the designs, breaking out the price points a little bit more, very much like they did with the iPod back when they had gained so much attrition and market share. And then they started to break things out and we got the iPod Nano, the iPod Shuffle and all these different price points and things like that. So that Apple could stay ahead of the competition and sort of flush out the product line and available options for their consumers. And then the other thing that happened of significance when Cook was in China is he did announce that Apple would be bringing out the cellular versions of the iPad mini before the end of the month in China. And then just a day or so later, Apple came out with an official statement saying that those units would start shipping in the region this week. There's some potential good news for those of you who have been waiting on a new iMac order. It looks like availability should be improving, at least according to Digitimes. They say that LG, the display vendor for Apple's new iMac, has been having yield issues, which has been responsible for the long wait times on new iMac shipments. The issues seem to be the lamination process with the new panels. That's where they fused the LED to the glass layer. That enabled Apple in the new iMac to gain some thinness and achieve a little bit better clarity on the displays. The 21.5-inch model shipments have begun to improve, however, according to the report, and it says that LG is now shipping between 300,000 to 400,000 units a month. They say the supplier is also getting a handle on the larger displays and expect that we'll see shorter ship times on the 27-inch models over the next month as well. Apple this week quietly reduced the price of their Thunderbolt cables as well as introduced a new version. Apple recently reduced the price of its 2-meter Thunderbolt cable by $10 from $49.99 to $39.99 US. At the same time, they also introduced a new shorter half-meter version of the cable for $29.99. Both cables are available on Apple's online store, and I would assume at an Apple store near you. Intel also announced at CES that it was prepping its fiber optic version of Thunderbolt cables to get ready to ship sometime this year. The new optical versions should bring more speed with throughput up to 100 gigabits per second. That's about 10 times the current 10 gigabit per second theoretical maximum. The optical cabling will also allow for longer runs of cables up to 10 meters versus the 3 meters that are the current restriction on the copper-based cables. Intel has not given firm pricing or availability beyond saying that it will be here this year, but we can likely expect that the cables will be expensive. That was actually one of the reasons Intel cited for not releasing the fiber optic version from the get-go and going with the copper. The good news is that the cables, at least, should be backward compatible. That is because Intel includes a design that has a transceiver at each end of the Thunderbolt cable. Optical cables, though, while being faster and longer, will not support power. Intel says that's because of impedance issues over longer distances, making sending the up to 10 watts of power impractical. Apple recently released an update for the MacBook Air. EFI firmware update version 2.6 is available for mid-2012 MacBook Airs. Apple says it addresses a color issue when connecting to HDMI displays. It also fixes a problem that occurred when booting into Windows and addresses an issue where disconnecting a Thunderbolt cable before waking the computer from standby could cause the system to freeze. The update is available now from Software Update or from Apple's support website at apple.com/support and does require that you're running OS X version 10.8.2 or better. Predictions on Apple's first financial quarter are beginning to make the media rounds. Analysts are getting busy with their forecasts in advance of Apple's Q1 2013 earnings report call, which will happen on January 23rd. It's predicted that the iPhone will come in with a record-shattering number of units sold in the area of about 50 million. The actual range that most analysts are throwing out there seems to be between 43 to 63 million. And even on the low end, that beats Apple's previous record of 37 million units sold. KGI Securities analyst Ming-Chi Kuo put his estimate at about 52 million units. If that were accurate, it would mean an increase of 41% year over year. And while the iPhone sales are expected to have a good first quarter, Wall Street Journal is reporting that Apple has cut component orders in half for the iPhone 5 moving forward due to weaker than expected demand. The report, however, came quickly under dispute by a couple of different sources on a couple different fronts. NPT Display Research analysts said that those numbers weren't quite accurate. They claimed that the cuts were severe, but Apple reduced iPhone 5 display orders from 19 million to about 11 million to 14 million units, so not quite half. But that is something that NPD says is still a sign that iPhone demand is lower than Apple had hoped. Apple's stock dipped below 500 for the first time in a year on the Wall Street Journal report, and also because of related rumors that Apple is bowing to competitive pressure to compress their product release cycles and compete on price, thus reducing their margins and their potential earnings per share, something that has supposedly spooked investors. Some, however, are saying that the Wall Street Journal may simply be misinterpreting things. Stern Agee analyst Sha Wu told his investors in a report that iPhone demand, quote, remains robust, and that the reduction in component orders is simply due to improved yields. His sentiments reflected similar ones made by Wells Fargo analyst Maynard who said in addition that investors may have set unrealistic estimates on Apple's shipments and have given too much significance to supplier shifts and the more rapid product release cycles. Moving over to the iPad, iPads are also predicted to have done well for Apple, with shipments around 23 million units, which would be up about 49% from a year ago. On the Mac side, though, it may not be quite as positive. Apple's numbers are expected to be near, if not slightly lower than last year, according to different sources. IDC expects Apple's December quarter Mac numbers to be around 2.03 million units. That's just about 300,000 units shy of last year's numbers. That's actually a 0.2% decline year over year, but should beat the PC industry as a whole, which they predict to see an average decline of about 4.5%. Gartner is a bit more positive on Apple's December quarter numbers and also on PC sales in general. They say that Apple's US-based shipments were up about 5.4% year over year, while the PC market as a whole slid about 2.1%. Coincidentally, they think Apple will have shipped about 2.1 million Macs in the quarter. Even if the Mac numbers look like a bit of a shock and lower than should be expected, I don't think it's a surprise to Apple or anyone else. The trend of reduced PC and Mac sales is not surprising. NPD Display Research is already predicting that, just like Steve and Tim have said, 2013 will be the year that tablet shipments overtake PC shipments. And then finally, let's get to those predictions of new Apple products. We got more reports this year of a March iPad update. I told you last time that the Japanese blog Mac Takahara claimed Apple would push out an updated fifth generation iPad in March, and that other sources also claimed that the iPad mini would get a rev as well. This week saw Topeka Capital Markets analyst Brian White and RBC analyst Doug Freeman also saying that their checks show that's exactly what Apple plans to do. White used his checks at CES to support predictions that Apple would put out a lighter and thinner version of the iPad, as well as a new iPad mini. Freeman didn't give many details, but did say that Apple would be moving up the introduction of the next version of the iPad mini into March. Most believe that if there is an update, Apple will simply rev the mini to include a new Retina display. On the iPad 5th generation, it's predicted that it will be thinner and lighter and be a move to bring its design styling in line with the current iPhone and the iPad mini. So with the black, we'll have the black back as well as the white and silver designs that we see in the current iPhones. Speaking of the iPhones, there's also been a rumor of a spring iPhone update, the iPhone 5S being brought out a little bit earlier than expected. Jefferies analyst Peter Misick claims that his supply checks show Apple moving into production around March with an expected launch date of June or July. He claims actually seeing two different prototypes in testing. One is believed to be that rumored cheaper iPhone, and he doesn't give many details on what the 5S will include. The cheaper iPhone has been rumored to be using a plastic body more reminiscent of the iPhone 3G or 3GS. It's also predicted that if Apple did do a version of that model, it would have a 4-inch screen, but it would be a non-Retina. It would also incorporate Apple's new Lightning connector and likely be 3G only, so no LTE support, again, to keep the costs down. And lastly, we saw some signs this week that Apple may be getting ready to update its displays. There were reports that third-party resellers were showing stockouts of Apple's Thunderbolt displays, possibly signaling a refresh. If they do, it's likely we'll see a new 27-inch model that is thinner, more like the designs in the new iMac. And I personally wonder if a release of a new Apple display wouldn't coincide with the release of a new Pro system, something that Tim Cook alluded to being released in early 2013. So the timing seems right on that one. I would imagine that Apple would make some sort of significant announcement if they are putting out a new Pro system, but we haven't been hearing a lot of rumors on that front, which you think we would. Also, there were all those predictions that Apple might be doing or moving Mac Pro production into the U.S., and I would imagine it would take them a while longer to get that ramped up. So who really knows, but it seems to make sense that they'd want to release a display and a new Pro system at the same time, although I guess they could just quietly rev the Thunderbolt displays without releasing a new Pro system. And with that is going to be the news for this week. Now I want to get you some feedback that I received on my little rant I did on the last episode about apps, and more specifically App Store pricing, and my concerns that it's not going to end up being a sustainable environment for a number of developers in the long term. I got some great email and feedback from you, as well as this comment from Gary.
Hi, Adam. This is Gary. I wanted to provide some feedback about the last podcast with the topic of pricing and apps. I really liked your comment about the trial system, Apple not really having a great way to do that. And I find that that's my biggest obstacle in getting really great software out of the App Store on iOS. You really have to go off recommendations. And partly the reason why I follow your show so aggressively is to hear all the different comments about Mac as an insider. And then I follow a lot of other items on podcasts to hear recommendations for apps that are great and solve problems. That way I will pay, I've paid up to $40 for applications that have been recommended highly. But there is no real trial system. If you go out there and search for your own app to solve your own problem, it's very difficult. And when you do find something that looks pretty great, you read the reviews, and do you really want to bite the bullet on $29.95 to find out that it really doesn't solve your problem? So I was thinking about that, and I know a lot of apps seem to come out with a free version. That way you could try it, like limited functionality try. And I'm wondering, can they not just put an in-app purchase where you buy the full version if you liked it? Because you really can't return it. I mean, that would be really nice if you had a return policy that if you didn't like it, you could return it. But maybe that's a whole nother issue. I was thinking about your comment on app upgrades within the app. I think maybe we're spoiled that we get so many opportunities to have an app upgraded on iOS for free. They add lots of new functionality, additional. Where I think of it more as updates should be to prevent issues or maybe compatibility problems, but not all these enhancements, where I think perhaps they should be holding them back for newer versions. And just like Apple, when they reach an endpoint in software, then they come out with a newer version that you have to download. It kind of seems like that would be the way to go. And once again, maybe an in-app purchase. I really do want to get one password for myself, the new 4 version, but like you were saying, it's confusing. I really don't want to upgrade because I don't want to come across the problem where you got to migrate something or something goes wrong. I really just want to, you know, press the button, update, and pay the additional whatever it is to update it and know that it's all clean and organized. And that kind of brings me to the Mac App Store. I love it because it's clean and organized, but it is kind of sparse. There's not really a lot of solutions there to solve problems. It's very limited, but I do like the buying experience for the most part. A lot of the same problems are there that the iOS does, but I don't use it very often just because it seems very limited. So I also was kind of thinking about it as it pertains to the music industry and how, you know, music's cost, you know, 99 cents a track, or now I think $1.29. And when you buy an album, it's $9.99 or $14.99. If an artist wants to come out with a new remix or something, they'd have to, you know, come out with a new title or a new mix of that same version of music to kind of sell additional albums. So just wanted to provide some feedback about your podcast on pricing and apps. And I'm hoping, like you, to see some improvements going forward.
Hey, Gary, you know, I'm totally with you on that front. And I just want to address some of the comments that you made in there. On the in-app purchase front, I think that would be the ideal solution for a developer to be able to offer a trial version, and then you simply can buy within the app. It's somewhat similar to the trial versions of iBooks, although with iBooks, you get a limited version of the iBook, but then sort of on the last page, right, there's that button that says, hey, you want to buy the full book, click here, and you can go ahead and buy it. It'd be a little bit more seamless, I think, on the app front. The problem is that I think there's two things preventing developers from doing that with Apple's current app system. And one is that they want to be able to deliver a fully functional trial, usually. So they want you to have all of the features that are in the application. And I think with in-app purchase, if you do that under Apple's current rules, you have to add or get additional functionality for that in-app purchase. And even if that didn't exist, the problem is that there's no timeout on a trial version. So if a developer did deliver a trial version, they'd have to give you a fully functional trial, and there's no way after a set period for it to turn off your access to that. So they couldn't force an in-app purchase. Once you downloaded it, you kind of have full access to it, which is, I think, why you'll see a lot of developers put out a light version or a free limited version of the application as a whole separate application. So it would be awesome if they could do that. And it's the same kind of problem, I think, on the upgrade front. You mentioned, you know, so many of these developers will update their apps and they'll add a bunch of new functionality. And I think that's actually a symptom of the current system that Apple has set up. There is no way for a developer to push out an update that is a paid update. So they're either updating their existing applications for free, which personally, I don't think they should do, because again, going back to my original conversation, I don't think that's a sustainable business model. So that's when you see developers like AgileBits and 1Password just put out a whole new version of the app that causes this confusion that I was alluding to. It would be great if they could just charge, again, as you mentioned, an in-app purchase or some sort of smaller incremental fee to upgrade to get additional features. And I don't know that there's any way within Apple's current system to allow that. So I think they need to make some changes. You know, your comments about updates and new versions, I think, point out the exact issue that I'm talking about. Now, specifically on the 1Password front, I can tell you it's well worth the upgrade. I've been using the new version 4 for a while, and I really like it. I like the new interface, and I like a lot of the new features. It was a pretty seamless upgrade on that front. So if you're worried about migrating your data over, I don't know how you're doing yours, but I have mine synced through Dropbox. So I was able to just simply install the new version of the application or purchase the new version of the application. And once it was installed, it just had all of my data pulled into it through the syncing features. The last thing that I want to just address is the sparseness of the current Mac App Store. And I think a big reason for that is a lot of the issues that we're talking about. Well, I know one for sure is the fact that on the Mac side, the new sandboxing restricts a lot of the kinds of things that applications can do. And so there's whole batches of applications, specifically ones like Text Expander, that just simply can't operate or can't be sold through the App Store because of those restrictions. So they choose to go outside the App Store. So I think you see a lot of developers not entering the App Store because of those restrictions. I also think, though, that a lot of these issues that we're talking about in terms of having to sell family licensing out of the box. So if you buy a Mac app on the Mac App Store, you automatically get to install it on all of your computers for one set price. I think that's limiting developers and their ability to sell a non-family version versus a family version. Other things like the inability to give a trial version that times out so that people can try before they buy, and also the whole upgrade thing. They have the same kinds of problems on the Mac App Store, and that's what really prompted me to want to talk about it a little bit more on the show. I think those are the things that are leading to this environment where it makes it very hard for app developers to create a sustainable model in terms of selling to existing customers and being able to offer up trials and gain new customers through a try before you buy program. And also just the pricing is, we're seeing the same kinds of pricing issues on the Mac App Store that we see on iOS. There's all kinds of new developers entering the Mac App Store, which is great for our community, but oftentimes what they're doing is they're putting out really cheaper versions of the applications, not just in terms of price, but they're also duplicating features of other great applications, but not implementing as well. And so it becomes just this price competition, and getting visibility and getting being able to differentiate your product within that marketplace is really hard, especially when you can't do things like offer trial versions. So as you said, more and more consumers are having to rely on reviews. And not every consumer is going to go through that process. Someone just buying a new Mac and seeing the Mac App Store in there, that might be the only place that they're looking for software. And the concern is they're not finding the best titles there. And they're often, I think, not getting the best experience with that software that they're downloading. So this is the overall problem that I'm sort of talking about and that I think we need to have a real serious discussion about. And I want to see Apple step up maybe in the next year and really start to address and work with developers, because as I was saying, as I talk to more developers and talk to them about their long-term business models, they're literally telling me if it continues the way it is now, a lot of us aren't going to be around in 2 or 3 or 5 years from now, because the model that Apple is creating and the pricing scheme and the whole system that they're setting up just ultimately in the long run isn't really sustainable. So that's kind of where my thoughts are on it. I appreciate you sharing yours, and any of you who want to share additional comments or thoughts on this topic, please shoot me an email, mattcast@gmail.com. I'd also like to hear from some more developers. Maybe I can line up some interviews. I'll be at Macworld in a couple weeks, and I'll talk more, I'm sure, with a number of people about these issues, and hopefully we'll be able to provide some more coverage on future episodes. And then in addition to that comment, Gary, I guess you also had a question about the calendar, and this was something that I needed to do a little bit of looking into, but here was what Gary had to ask about that.
Hey, Adam, I just wanted to ask you one more thing while I was putting together my thoughts. Oftentimes I run across things I want to ask you, and I should ask Siri to make a note of it, but One of the big things that I come across every day is like the calendar on Mac, and I've got lots of different calendars, calendars on the Mac, calendars in iCloud, calendars on Google, calendars on my Exchange server for work, calendars that are, you know, delegates of other Google calendars and subscriptions. So some of them I have full rights and access to use, some of them I do not, but all the ones that I have full rights and access to use, I put different things on there, so they're all in different colors and on different calendars. I'm wondering, is there a quick way to switch between them when I'm adding new items? Because the method I do now is I have to go into the calendar and then choose preferences and then choose default calendar and then switch it to whichever calendar I want to make a new event in. Otherwise, it's always for whatever default calendar it is. Thought maybe it would be really intuitive if you, on the left panel where you show your calendars, if you clicked on the calendar that you kind of want to see or do things with, you click it, and then you can go ahead and make a calendar event for that. And it doesn't seem to work like that. So maybe I'm doing something wrong. If you have any insights on that, that would be terrific. Thanks, Adam.
Hey, Gary. Yep. I was a little bit confused by this, actually, at first. And Gary and I did a little bit of back and forth because, you know, the way I think about it is when you add an event into the calendars, you get that little event window both on the Mac and on the iOS. And then there is a little calendars section and you can click on that as you're adding the event. And then you can select the calendar that you want to add the event to. But after doing some emailing back and forth with Gary and getting some screenshots and stuff like that, what I realized was is that he's really talking about on the Mac when you go in and you use the create quick event button. And in Apple's calendar application, that's that little plus icon that's up at the top of the window, and then it drops down a little dialog box and you can enter your event information there. And then when you hit enter, it goes into whatever default calendar you have set up in the settings, just like Gary was alluding to. So sounds like, Gary, you're going into that setting, changing it so that you can get it to go automatically into the calendar you want. And it saves that extra click of having to actually click, open up the little info dialog box, and then find that calendar section, and then select the drop down to select the calendar. So it's multiple steps. This is really kind of an efficiency thing. So the question is there a way to save clicks? And I wasn't sure on this. I actually had to do a little bit of research, but it turns out, yes, there absolutely is. And the trick is that instead of just clicking that little plus button to add a quick event, you need to just click and hold on it for a second or two. And then what will happen is it will actually drop down a list of all your calendars, and it'll show the default calendar with a check mark next to it, but you can pick any calendar you want. And then when you do that, it will give you the quick entry dialog box. You can enter in the event that you want to enter, and when you hit the enter button, it's going to add that to the calendar that you selected, regardless of what your default calendar is set to. So that saves you the step. You could still, in that dialog box, again, change the calendar, whatever calendar it's assigned to. So you can, in addition, you know, make that change at that point, but you really don't need to if you just click and hold before you add that quick event. And then another handy tip that I discovered as I was going through this, because I have mine in the calendar preferences, when I go into calendar preferences under general, I've set the default calendar to a specific calendar, but you can actually set it so that it changes to whatever the last calendar you added events to is. And this can be handy if you find that you're continually adding calendars in kind of groups or events, excuse me, in groups to the same calendar. It'll kind of remember the last setting that you had and automatically by default add to that. So if you go under the default calendar option, down at the bottom, you'll notice there's a last selected calendar. And now if you pick that, when you add a new event, they will always be assigned to the last calendar that you added an event to by default. So that may be helpful to you as well, Gary. But again, thanks for the feedback and the question. Now I have an email question that I received actually from a couple of you over the past week, and I think this is something we may have covered on the show in the past, but I can never remember, and since it's come up again, I think it's worth recovering, and that is the other category that is on your iOS devices. So if you connect your iOS device to iTunes, and then you go to the device screen, down at the bottom, you get that little graph that shows all of your storage broken out by the different categories. So you'll see audio and video and photos and apps and books and also the amount of free space. But there's also this other category. And, you know, while audio, video, books, those are pretty self-explanatory, you can understand what's stored in those sections, it can be confusing as to what exactly that other category is. And very often that other category ends up being one of the biggest categories that has the most data in it. And the reason for that is that it is all of the data information that kind of doesn't fit into the other categories. For example, music or specific application data. And while you might think that that stuff should be under the music section or the application section, it really isn't. And that's because basically the other place is the place for the operating system and other applications to use as storage. So things like documents, if it's a document-based application, settings, cache files, offline files, things like that are going to fall into that other category. And it's sort of, I think, because of how Apple's system is set up in terms of the sandboxing in the areas that applications are allowed to store their data in. So like, whereas iTunes can put stuff into the video category or the audio category in terms of your actual like music files and things like that, additional files that come from other places have to be stored in that other section. So examples of that kind of offline data would be things for, say, you have an application like Instapaper or Pocket. When you download those offline files, those are going to go into that other category. Similarly, if you use a third-party podcast application, something like Instacast or Downcast, and you allow those to download local files, they're going to go under other applications that do PDFs like GoodReader or PDF Pen, or even your iWork documents that are stored locally, those are all going to fall into that other area. And so if you want to see specifically what is being stored in that area or just how much from each application is being stored in that area, one of the really simple ways to see that is to go into your iOS device, go under Settings, General, and click on the Usage section. And then within Usage, you'll want to click on the Show All Apps option under the list of the apps. So when it comes up, it's going to show you kind of the apps that are using the most storage. To see all of your applications, click Show All Apps under that storage section. And then from there, what you'll see is the total storage used by that application and its data. So that's important because it's the application, like how big the application is itself, plus the data that is stored by that application in that other section. So to see the details, what you want to do is you want to actually click on the application, and then under its title, what you'll be able to see is the version and the actual application size. That's how much storage it's using up in that apps portion when you look at that graph. But if you want to see what that application is specifically using in that other section, what you want to look at is the data part that's listed here. And it'll be listed as documents and data, and it will show you how much storage it's using. And what you'll notice there is that sometimes from the first screen, when you see that summary of the app and its data, it really doesn't necessarily give you an indication of whether that app is using more storage in the app section or more storage in the other section. What you can find is that you might click on an app thinking, oh, this is storing a lot of data, and find out that it's the application itself, maybe a game or something like that, that has a lot of assets and resources, but the actual data portion that it's storing in the other section might be relatively small because it might just be things like your high score or your progress within the game. But you click on another application that might be relatively small in terms of its app storage, say something like an iWork application, and then in the documents and data portion, it's actually storing a lot more data inside that category. So document-based applications like Pages and things like that tend to store more data and use up less app storage. So some apps like Apple's applications for video and music from this screen will actually let you delete their data, and you can get it out of your iOS device simply by swiping across the data portion, and then you end up with a little delete button. And I tell you this because actually one of the biggest users of your other data, if you use iTunes Music Match service, tends to be the music application. So if you go into Music and you go under that data and documents portion, you might see a lot of stuff stored there. And that's because when you are streaming your music through iTunes Match on your iOS device, it's downloading that stuff in the background and storing it into that storage portion on your iOS device. So you can actually come in here and actually delete that data out of here. I looked on mine and I had about 2 gigabytes of data in my music. You can actually delete it out of there, and it's not actually going to delete the music that you sync over to your device. It's just deleting all of those cached files and things like that from that other portion of your storage. So that's worthwhile in doing. For third-party applications, though, you can't come into the settings general usage area and actually delete data directly from there. You could delete the entire application, which is also going to delete its data as well, but to actually get its specific, say, offline data, if you're using an application like Pocket, out of there, what you're going to probably need to do is actually go within the application itself and see if it has a method for actually removing or purging that data from its system. Beyond that, if it doesn't offer that functionality, really the only way to get that data out of there would be to fully uninstall the application itself. When you uninstall an app, it should also go through and remove any of its data or document storage from that other portion of your drive. Now, occasionally, the last thing you need to know about with that other category is that sometimes things go awry and it will get stuck. Data will get stuck in there or corrupted, and it'll start rapidly growing, and you'll notice that it's consuming more and more data. It's usually, like I said, some sort of bug or corruption within the data. The recommended fix for doing that generally is that you go into iTunes, connect your device, and that you do a backup and then a full restore of the device, which should wipe out data and sort of reset things. There is another recommended fix that I ran across, and I tried this. It didn't seem to remove too much data when I did it, but I did get a small adjustment in the amount of storage in that other area, and that is to connect your device to iTunes using a charge sync cable, and then restart the device while it's connected while holding down your sleep-wake button, just until you see the Apple logo, let go, and then force it to reset the device. If you hold it too long, your device will go into recovery mode, and you definitely don't want that, because that's going to force you to do a reinstall. If that does happen to you, you can just disconnect from iTunes, eject your device or disconnect it, and then restart the device once it's disconnected from iTunes, and that should put it back into its normal functioning mode, and you can try again. But that's really why I recommend, if you have corrupt or what appears to be stuck data where suddenly that other portion just keeps growing and nothing you can do, uninstalling applications or trying some of these other methods clears that out, you're probably going to want to just do a backup and restore of your device, and that should fix things up. But that's what that other portion is there for and is used for, and hopefully that helps some people with their confusion on that. I don't know about you, but I had a little bit of a scare this week thanks to the U.S. Department of Homeland Security. They announced that they had found a serious zero-day exploit flaw in Java version 7, and they recommended that all users immediately turn it off until it was patched by Oracle. And, you know, Apple removed Java from OS X, starting with OS X Mountain Lion, but I knew that I had a version of Java installed because I use CrashPlan, and I use it for my backups, and I've even recommended it to you on occasion, and so I need to run Java, and I didn't want to necessarily disable it and lose my backups, and so I was really confused by the statement, and I kind of went researching to figure out, you know, do I need to turn it off? How do I turn it off? What do I do? What's the exploit? And so I just wanted to share some of the things that I found out about that, because I think you may be confused just as I was. You know, is Java inherently insecure on my Mac? Am I going to be in trouble? What exactly is going on? And real quick up front, luckily it turned out that CrashPlan was and is not impacted by this vulnerability, because the exploit was only for Java running in the browser, and it was also only if you happen to be running Java version 7, and CrashPlan actually uses Java version 6, and I'm going to explain in a little more detail as to why that is. But I did have to do a lot of digging to figure all of this stuff out, and so I didn't want to have you to have to do the same kind of digging that I did too. luckily for me, when I went to do my digging, I have friends who can help me out, and specifically John Martellaro over at the Mac Observer. He is kind of into this stuff. He is a systems guy, and he likes to write about some of the security stuff, and he dug in pretty deep over on macobserver.com. So I'm going to have a link to his full article in the show notes. But here's the facts that you need to know about this. Up until 2012, Apple did integrate a version of Java into Mac OS X. It came pre-installed, and that was up through Java version 6. Now, in Mountain Lion, as I was saying, it does not come with Java pre-installed, so unless you actually specifically installed it, you won't have it. And the operating system, if you need it, will ask you to install a version. And if you do install that, it will happen automatically. It will download a version, but it still downloads version 6. Now, Oracle is taking on updating the OS X version of Java moving forward, and that's starting with version 7. If you want to check which version of Java you have on your system, if it is indeed installed, you can open up a terminal window. Just go to Applications, Utilities, Launch Terminal, and then type the command Java and then a space dash version and hit enter, and it will pop up and it will tell you what version you have installed. If you do, you'll likely see something like Java version 1.6.0_37. I think the 3.7 is the build of whatever version of Java you have installed. And notice that Java versions are versioned based on the number that is after the dot. So 1.n with the n signaling the version number. So if you see 1.6, that means you have Java version 6. If you see 1.7, that would indicate that it's Java version 7. And if you do this command and OS X prompts you to install Java, that means you don't have Java already installed and you probably do not need to install it. So you can just cancel out of that. Don't worry about it. But again, even if you did, it's going to install Apple's Java version 6 and not the Oracle version 7, which has this problem. The other thing to know about this problem is it really is only the Java plugin that you need to be concerned about. And as a matter of fact, on the 10th, Apple issued through their security mechanisms a command to actually disable the Java plugin on every Mac to stop it from working. So Apple was already kind of having everybody's back on this front, although they likely didn't need to do that because, once again, the exploit only impacted version 1.7, and most people did not run out and install the Oracle version of Java. But I guess in Apple's case, they decided that it's better to be safe than sorry. And standalone applications do not use the Java plugin, so they were not affected by the exploit. Most Java applications, if you have them installed on your system, are going to be using the system-level version of Java, Java Runtime Environment, JRE of the system, and at this point, Mac apps like CrashPlan are built and written for Java version 6. So in order to get Java version 7 now, what you would actually have to do is you'd have to specifically go to Oracle's website. And if you want to, there's actually a test page you can go to see if you have the plugin installed, and it will tell you what version of the applet or what version of the Java plugin you have installed by running an applet. And that's what happens when you encounter Java on the web. It will prompt you to run an application, and if you say okay, then that application will start to run. In the case of this little test page, it'll run the test application and show you what version you have. And so if you go to java.com/testjava, you can check this out. But if you have your plugin disabled, and Apple may have disabled it for you, nothing's going to happen when you run on that page. If you do want to update your plugin, you can update it from that page, and that's the place to get it. And when you do run the update, the plugin is going to get installed in your library folder under Internet Plugins. So there's an Internet Plugins folder inside your library folder, and I believe that's the one in your home user account. It might also install at the one at the root level of your system, so I would actually check both places if you're looking for it. But the plugin that gets installed from that test page is a standalone version, and it has the Java Runtime Environment, the latest build that Oracle just patched to counteract this exploit, JRE version 1.7.0_11-B21. That's the specific build. It has that baked into the plugin. So That will allow you to, if you do need to run your plugin in your browser, you're going to want to grab that version, install that, and then you will be protected against this latest exploit. Once again, most users only want to update their plugin, not the Java runtime environment itself. And then once you do install the plugin update, what Java will do is a couple things. It's going to install a Java preference pane. So if you go into your system preferences, you'll have a new Java preference file. And from there, you can check the version of the plugin and what the runtime environment it's running is. And you'll see that listed. And you also notice the path, and it should show that the only Java you have installed is installed in that /library/internet plugins folder. What you really want to avoid doing is installing the Java development kit. So if you end up on the Oracle website and you're in the Java section and you see an installer that says JDK or Java Development Kit, you really don't want to install that unless you're a developer. Developers are the only people who need to install that. And if you were installing it as a developer, you would know what you're doing and you'd be able to take, you know, the necessary precautions. But if you did install the JDK, it's going to install version 1.7.0_11 of the Java runtime environment at the operating system level. And at that point, it is going to overwrite or blow away the OS X 1.6.0 version of Java. And that is the version that your OS X applications are going to rely on if you're running Java-based applications on your system. And that, if you do that, applications like CrashPlan are going to break. So you really don't want to do it. What is really interesting from that standpoint is that Oracle did patch the 1.6 version of the Java runtime environment. So the one that Apple is running, as I mentioned, I think was 1.6.0_38. There is now a 1.6.0_39, but Oracle did not create a new build for OS X. They only updated the build of Java version 7. So that was what was going on, and that's just some of the information surrounding the latest Java updates. So I hope that helps. And then finally today, I want to talk about using dictation, both in iOS and Mac OS X. You know, one of the features of iOS and OS X that I find myself using more and more is the dictation feature. And I'm mostly using it these days for texts and email, especially when I'm on my iPhone. It's pretty easy for me to type on my iPad and my Mac, but on the iPhone, that little keyboard can be a little bit frustrating to use. And I'm just finding that using the dictation feature, clicking on the little microphone, makes it a lot easier to get stuff in, and it's a lot faster than typing, at least for me. I know some people can fly with their thumbs on the keyboard, but I'm not falling into that camp, and I haven't gotten that much more efficient. So I thought what I'd do is share a couple of helpful tips that I've been using to make myself a little bit more productive with the dictation feature. And one of those is using the Raise to Speak feature that's built into iOS. So if you go into Settings, General, and into the Siri settings, you can turn on the Raise to Speak option. And the reason I like this is that it seems to always work better than just kind of talking into the phone after pressing the Siri button, because you can get it up by your mouth. Siri tends to recognize your dictation a little bit easier. And plus, it helps in those situations where you would feel a bit awkward sort of talking to your phone. It looks like you're out loud talking to yourself. And if you raise the phone to your ear, most people think that you're just having a cell phone conversation. And that's pretty common nowadays. So you don't get too many weird looks unless you're doing it in a place where it's just socially inappropriate, right? You should make sure that you're not, in the middle of church or something like that, using the Raise to Speak feature to dictate to your phone. That's definitely a no-no. But just doing that seems to help. And it also seems that the dictation feature is better recognized when I use it in that respect. The other thing that is generally helpful is if you just enunciate clearly. And that doesn't necessarily mean talk like a robot or talk weird, but just simply talk normally and at a normal volume. You don't need to shout. and just make sure that you clearly speak each word and that you don't go too fast, too slow. Slurred speech can be particularly problematic. The other thing I think is don't freak out about the accuracy at first. You know, my experience was good out of the box, but if you have an accent, if you have maybe a regional dialect or something like that, it might not work 100% from day one. It's going to get some, it's going to miss some things, but the more and more you use it, the more it seems to improve. And you can simply, once you've dictated, use the keyboard and the autocorrect suggest feature to just correct the words that it missed. You know, simply double tapping on a word, tapping on the suggest option, and then just doing that correction is much faster than sort of redictating or worrying too much about the accuracy. And like I said, it's going to get more accurate over time. The other thing to remember is that you can only dictate in 30-second chunks. So don't think that you're going to be able to write a novel through dictation. But 30 seconds actually turns out to be longer than you might think. So don't panic either and try and rush what you're saying out. Just, again, speak normally, and I think you'll be surprised at how much you can actually get it to dictate and to convert for you. And then the last bit of advice would be you need to kind of learn to speak your punctuation if you want to get really efficient at it. And you feel silly at first, I have to admit. You know, saying period and question mark is a little bit odd, but once you start doing that and once you learn the commands, it's incredibly powerful how much you can actually do with the dictation feature. As a matter of fact, Apple has a support article on its website that I'll link to in the show notes that lists out all of the commands that you can use. But there's some obvious ones like period, comma, question mark, exclamation point. Another good tip to remember is the open and close options. So if you need braces or brackets, you can say things like open parentheses and then speak what you want within the parentheses and then say close parentheses. There's also some capitalization and caps features that are activated by the on and off commands. So you can say things like all caps on, and then start dictating, and everything you say from that point forward will be in all caps. And then you just simply say all caps off, and it will stop doing that. You also, if you need to do a new line or new paragraph, there's a new line command, there's a new paragraph command, there's a spacebar command if you want to force a space. And then things like numbers, sometimes you actually want to have it write the numeric version of the number, not just type out the number. So for that, you'll use the word numeral. So if you just say numeral 2 instead of just simply 2, you'll end up with the number rather than T-W-O spelt out. And then if you add sign for a number of symbols, you can actually get the symbol. So something like copyright sign or trademark sign will actually generate the symbol that you want for that. And then the last thing that's kind of fun is you can actually speak a couple of emoticons. So if you say smiley face, frowny face, or winky face, it'll result in translating into the emoticon for that. And like I said, there's a full list up on Apple's site, and I'll have the link in the show notes at maccast.com. But if you haven't played around with dictation too much, play around with it, see how your accuracy is. But I think you're going to be surprised at how good it is. And, you know, Apple uses the Dragon engine and technology in the background, and I think that's proven itself over the years. And you really can do a lot of powerful things with it if you just do a little bit of research and dive in a little bit more. So I hope you find that interesting and that helps you out. But I think that's going to do it for this episode for this week. Before I leave you, I do want to take a quick moment and thank all of my show sponsors. Circus Ponies, makers of Notebook. You can check out their software as well as get a free trial over at circusponies.com. Smile, makers of Text Expander, PDF Pen, Disc Label, also PDF Pen for iPhone and iPad, as well as Text Expander Touch. You can find information on all their software, as well as get trials of the Mac applications over at smilesoftware.com. Gazelle, you know, what's your iPhone, your iPad worth? Take a minute to find out. Go to gazelle.com, that's G-A-Z-E-L-L.com, and get a quote. And Squarespace, you know, if you're looking to build a good, maintainable website in minutes, not hours or days, you can do that with Squarespace. And best of all, you can try it completely free, no obligation. Just go to squarespace.com/maccast to sign up. And if you choose to get an account, you can get 10% off with the offer code MACCAST1. That's M-A-C-C-A-S-T-1. And ShareFile by Citrix. Take all the hassle out of sharing and sending your business files via old methods like email attachments and FTP by using ShareFile. Try it risk-free for 30 days. Just go to ShareFile.com, click on the radio microphone, and enter my offer code MACCAST, M-A-C-C-A-S-T. And again, that's ShareFile.com/MACCAST, ShareFile by Citrix. And a big thank you to all of my sponsors for their support of the MACCAST. Got a couple few other things to let you know about. I am going to be at Macworld coming up on January 31st. It runs January 31st through February 2nd in San Francisco at Moscone Center. If you're going to be there, I'm going to be recording a live episode of the MACCAST from the show floor, from the expo floor. And anybody with an expo pass can get in to see that. That's on Friday, February 1st from 2:30 to 3:30 p.m. And I plan to interview Macworld attendees and MacCast fans. So if you're around, you're going to be around, shoot me an email in advance. I can get you lined up to come on the show. I just want to ask you about the show, what you're seeing at the show, why you come to the show, things like that. It should be a lot of fun. Shoot me an email, maccast@gmail.com, if you'd like to participate in that. And if you need to get in to see the show and you want a free pass, I do have free expo hall passes available. There's details on the MacCast Facebook page at facebook.com/TheMacCast, also on the Google Plus community, or just shoot me an email and I will get you a link for those passes. I will also have a link in the show notes at MacCast.com. So a bunch of ways to get a free pass to Macworld, iWorld coming up here at the end of the month. And then there's also our Disneyland Mac Geek Day. If you want to come join Dave Sparks, Mac Sparky and I, we're going to be getting together with a bunch of Mac geeks at Disneyland in California for a little informal meetup. It's going to happen on Saturday, January 26th. That's the weekend before Macworld. So come on out. It's basically a chance for a bunch of us to get together in the same area and kind of hang out. You're going to have to get your own ticket to Disneyland, but beyond that, I think we'll try and get together maybe for a group photo. There are actually details and more information up on a website we threw up, and actually that website was built with Squarespace. Made it really easy to get that site up and running for you, and that's at DisneyMacGeek.com. So if you go to DisneyMacGeeks.com, then you can get all the details there, and I hope to see you, and feel free to sign up. We have a little sign up on the Google Plus community. Just let us know you're going to be there so we can kind of get a head count and an idea of how many people are coming. But that's going to do it for today. If you have any feedback for me, any comments, a question, something you'd like to hear covered on a future show, you can send those to maccast@gmail.com. You can also call in on the listener hotline. That's at 281-622-4269, 281-622. MacIM9. You can leave voicemail there. You can also leave voicemail on Skype, and my Skype address is TheMacCast. And if you need show notes, links to anything that I talked about on this or any other episode of the MacCast, you can find those on the website at maccast.com. While you're there, be sure to check out the forum at forum.maccast.com. And then if you want to follow me online, I'm on Twitter, twitter.com/MacCast. Also the Facebook page I mentioned earlier, facebook.com/TheMacCast, and the new MacCast Google Plus community on Google Plus. Any one of those places, great place to hang out, have conversations with other Mac geeks and fans of the MacCast, and I hope to see you there. That'll do it for now. Until next time, I will talk to you all again real soon.